From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Jonathan Lethem. He won a National Book Critics Circle Award for his novel Motherless Brooklyn. His new book, The Fortress of Solitude, is a semi-autobiographical novel based on his experiences growing up in Brooklyn in the 70s. The main character's hippie mother brags that he is just one of a few white children in his school, but despite her pride, it's tough. He faces constant bullying and a great deal of cultural confusion. Also today, actress Maggie Gyllenhaal. She's one of the stars of the new John Sayles movie, Casa de los Babies. She played the title role in the film Secretary, about a withdrawn young woman who was awakened by an S&M relationship with her boss. In the film Donnie Darko, she played the sister, opposite her real brother, Jake Gyllenhaal. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Justice Department has launched a full-scale investigation into the leak of the name of a CIA operative, but Attorney General John Ashcroft has decided not to appoint an outside counsel to look into the matter. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The Attorney General confirmed today the Justice Department has undertaken a full-scale investigation of the leak with the help of the FBI.
Yesterday, the Department of Justice informed the White House Counsel's Office of this investigation and requested that the White House preserve all documents that might be relevant to the investigation.
The investigation is trying to figure out who disclosed that the wife of former Ambassador Joseph Wilson is a CIA operative. Administration critics demanded the appointment of an outside counsel and have asked whether the name was leaked to punish Wilson for questioning claims about Iraq's nuclear weapons programs before the war. Ashcroft would not comment on why he's decided not to turn to a special counsel for an investigation. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Federal agents have arrested a third person who worked at the U.S. prison camp in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Ahmed Mahalbi was arrested at a Boston airport after customs agents found classified information on a compact disc in his luggage. He's charged with making false statements about the contents of the disc. The Egyptian-American was working as a translator at the camp for suspected al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters. Last week, another Guantanamo translator was arrested and charged with spying. A third man, a Muslim chaplain at the camp, is being held without charges. Belgium's biggest terrorism trial has ended with the convictions of more than 20 people, allegedly with links to al-Qaeda. Douglas Baction reports.
Most of the suspects were of North African origin and were convicted of crimes including trafficking in false passports, conspiracy to commit a crime, and membership in a private militia. The Brussels court found lead suspect Nazar Trabelsi guilty of planning to blow himself up at Belgium's Klein-Brouwel Air Base, where nuclear weapons are believed to be stored. Trabelsi admitted to planning to drive a car bomb into the cafeteria at the facility. He was arrested in 2001, shortly after the September 11th attacks in the United States. Trabelsi said he had met Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan and asked to become a suicide bomber. Trabelsi received a 10-year sentence. The four-month trial was held under very tight security. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Baction in Luxembourg City.
The Senate Appropriations Committee has unanimously approved President Bush's emergency request for $87 billion to fund operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. The bill faces what could be contentious debate on the Senate floor. In stocks, the Dow lost 105 points to close at 92.75. The Nasdaq is down 37 at 17.86. This is NPR News. Independent candidate Arianna Huffington may be preparing to drop out of California's gubernatorial recall race. Huffington's campaign says she's to make a major announcement in a scheduled appearance tonight on CNN's Larry King Live program. The latest polls show the political columnist with no more than 5% of the vote. Huffington told supporters today that her main priority is to keep the California governor's office out of Republican hands. A fire on the north rim of the Grand Canyon has doubled in size and could force park officials to close a highway leading into the national park. Arizona Public Radio's Laurel Drewley reports.
Since Monday, the so-called Poplar Fire has doubled in size to nearly 7,000 acres. Park officials are strongly advising visitors to leave the North Rim. The fire, which was started by lightning, threatens the North Rim entrance station, cabin, and power line. The wildfire's rapid spread has made it necessary to close Highway 67 to southbound traffic. Park officials predict the blaze will cause them to close the entire highway at the park's boundary, making it impossible to travel in and out of the park's north rim over the next several days. About 300 firefighters are working to put out the fire. For NPR News, I'm Laurel Drewley in Flagstaff.
Consumer confidence fell in September in part because of the weak labor market. The Conference Board, a private business research group, said its index of consumer confidence fell by almost 5 points to 76.8. Lynn Franco, the board's director of consumer research, said consumers are still cautiously optimistic about economic conditions over the next 6 months and are likely to keep spending at current levels. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, embracing the diversity of more than 100,000 employees across America and the people they serve. SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jonathan Lethem, won a National Book Critics Circle Award for his novel Motherless Brooklyn. Now Lethem has a new novel called The Fortress of Solitude that's based on his own experiences growing up in Brooklyn. The novel revolves around two best friends, Dylan Ebdis and Mingus Rude, who live in a largely African-American neighborhood in Brooklyn. When the novel begins in the 70s, Dylan is one of the few white students in his grade school. His mother is a hippie. His father is a painter. Mingus is the son of a soul singer who used to be in a popular vocal group. The novel begins in the 70s, ends in the 90s, and follows the neighborhood through the changes of hip-hop, crack, and gentrification, and follows the two main characters' diverging paths as Dylan goes to a predominantly white college in Vermont and Mingus goes to prison. Reviewing the novel in the New York Times Sunday Book Review, A.O. Scott described it as melancholy and marvelous. Your new book really confronts the issue of race and what it's like to grow up as a white child in a largely African-American neighborhood. Race is a very difficult subject to write about. Was it hard for you to take it on?
Well, I avoided it for years. I wrote a whole series of novels that dealt with questions of difference and alienation very indirectly. So, of course, it was intimidating. And then in the doing, I was constantly afraid that I'd wander into pontificating or sociology or trying to do something I'm not good at. And I just kept reminding myself that I wanted to make it very much an intimate report, a kind of a testimony from one body's experience moving through time, but not try to speak for anyone.
Now, this is a semi-autobiographical novel, and you're writing from the point of view of a white kid who's growing up in an African-American neighborhood that calls into question what it means to be a majority group or a minority group, because the white kid is, after all, the member of the majority group, the theoretically more powerful group, but in his neighborhood, he's the minority group, and he's the kid who's picked on a lot.
Right.
So it's a very kind of confusing territory to be in.
It's sort of a double reverse, and yet all of the, you know, wider context of American society was sort of present, I think, on those streets where I grew up, and I've given Dylan the burden of those experiences. The fact that a white kid had different kind of escape routes, different ways to move out of those streets and those very immediate and confusing racial conflicts that Dylan lives through, that was never out of anyone's mind. The fact that I was sort of free to export myself to college and to an America where the white majority was, of course, the rule, wasn't lost on anyone.
Now, the parents in the novel have chosen to live in this neighborhood because, well, first of all, they don't have much money. And also, it's a kind of badge of their social consciousness. The father is an artist. The mother sees herself as a social activist. What were your parents' motivations for living in the neighborhood you lived in? And you should describe that neighborhood.
Well, I grew up in a neighborhood that's now called Borum Hill. And just before that, it was either a nameless place or it was South Brooklyn or Gowanus. It was kind of a zone between the more upright and already gentrified or middle-class neighborhoods of Brooklyn, like Park Slope and Brooklyn Heights. And the neighborhood was really a patchwork. It wasn't only black by any means. It was black and Hispanic and hippie and sort of other. There were legacies of Native Americans living in the neighborhood because for whatever reason, the Native Americans who built the skyscrapers had settled in Borum Hill. And my parents were attracted to it, I think in a very beautiful and, you know, and hopeful way. My mother grew up in Queens, and felt like a Brooklyn street kid herself. My father was a painter looking for a home big enough to include a studio, and this was a place where you could buy a townhouse for kind of nothing. And the contradictions of a coming gentrification and the way that would compromise their own political ideals was something that was hard to anticipate.
Now, the mother in your novel boasts that her son is one of only three white children in the whole school, the elementary school. Did your mother have that attitude, too? And are there things you thought she didn't understand about what it meant to be one of the very few white kids in the elementary school?
Well, that's a good question. She was proud that we were in public school when a lot of the other white kids in the neighborhood were being exported to local private schools. But she wasn't nearly as scattershot or flighty as the character Rachel in the book. My mother was pretty savvy about street life and a great guide to the neighborhood. She actually really knew the way things were playing out on the streets and in the schools. She was sick. She died when I was 14, and she was sick for a few years before that. So her kind of savvy and her know-how was unfortunately taken away.
Did you stay in the neighborhood after she died? I think your parents were separated by then.
We lived in the neighborhood, and my father continued to live in the neighborhood until just a few years ago. And I'm actually back there myself. Of course, it's a neighborhood that's become very, very fashionable now. It's one of the nicest parts of New York City to live in, I think.
Is that bizarre for you to experience?
Well, it's wonderful. I mean, the simplest thing to say is it's a nice place for me, as it would be for anyone. And if I weren't from Borum Hill, I very well might have ended up living there again, or living there for the first time now, because it's attractive. And I see it with a kind of double vision. I see the old stuff, which is still incompletely renovated. You know, the thing about Brooklyn that I think sets it apart from Manhattan is that it never renovates completely. The past is always sort of lying around in chunks in full view if you want to see it. And as much as it's changed and as much as obviously property values have skyrocketed, there are lots of kids I grew up with living in the houses that their parents owned. There are lots of parts of Smith Street and Court Street that are still deeply, you know, deep ethnic enclaves of Dominicans or Puerto Ricans or Italians. And it doesn't feel to me that it's ever going to change completely.
Kids are always bullying kids. And that's just the way the world works, I guess. But when you were bullied in the neighborhood you were growing up, did race come into play into that bullying?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the search for me in trying to write this book was to give name to something, an experience that I'd had and never been able to talk about because it fell kind of between the names I was offered. You know, when I first left New York, I was asked a question people who grew up in New York, especially in the 70s, are asked constantly, which is, have you ever been mugged? And I wouldn't know what to say. It seemed so simple, but I knew what they had in mind was a kind of, you know, Kojak or Batman scenario where a guy with a handkerchief on his face, you know, pulls a gun out and makes two well-dressed New Yorkers step into an alley and, you know, says, your money or your life. And that hadn't happened to me, certainly. But that what had happened to me wasn't only bullying. It wasn't only typical schoolyard stuff, that there was a undercurrent of, you know, racial hazing in the kind of experience I'd had that it was systematic, but it was also inconsistent. The experience changed a lot, and it was very slippery and hard to talk about. In fact, its unnameability was almost its primary quality. You were told at the time, this isn't anything. I'm taking your money, but I'm your friend. You know I like you. What do you think? I'm not your friend? Are you a racist? And the kind of undercurrent of, rehearsals of racial identity was everywhere in this experience. I knew I was meant to understand that I was a white boy, and that that entitled me to certain privileges, but it also meant that, you know, I was going to pay a kind of toll of my bus pass or whatever pocket money I had with me pretty much every day I went to school, and that I wasn't going to get to talk about it, because to do so would be to seem to be a racist.
You did give a name to this.
Yeah, yoking. It's a funny story. I took that word for local vernacular. I really thought when the kids in my neighborhood would say, throw a yoke on him, or, you know, you got yoked, that it was something so specific to the 70s and to Brooklyn and to the black and Hispanic kids. And I suppose slang always seems a lot more recent than it really is, but it turns out yoking is kind of, it goes back to like 18th century English slang. It's a synonym for mugging, having to do with specifically kind of an arm thrown around a neck, a headlock. And it was really liberating to me when I discovered that the word had some provenance, that it wasn't just my own sort of personal nightmare.
And why is yoking better than mugging?
Well, yoking was, as I say, this intermediate activity. It wasn't real crime. It wasn't totally hostile. It had a conversational quality. It was, in a weird way, it was a kind of active community making. I was yoked by a lot of guys I knew, and I was often hanging out with them shortly thereafter. Or, you know, I was yoked by the older brothers of kids I was hanging out with. It was a transaction, and I ended up feeling that it was kind of a rehearsal.
Were you able to talk to your mother about this?
Barely. I mean, it took me years to talk even to friends who'd gone through it with me in school. It was something that was unnameable in full view. My brother and my good friends were part of this experience too, and it was something that we were so ashamed of that we'd erase it almost instantly. We'd erase it walking home from school before we got a chance to talk to our parents about it.
There's another white boy who moves into the neighborhood, but your main character doesn't want to deal with him because his character is weak, and he gives off the sense of being oppressed. And your main character describes this kid as practicing preemptive suffering. Nobody could do much with a kid who was already crying. He didn't have a spirit to crush. Was that your observation of other kids when you were growing up?
Actually, that's as much confession as it is an observation. I had when I started to kind of research this book, which was really in some ways like it was the first scholarship I've ever done in my life. I was a college dropout and I'd never learned to study, but I sort of had to write a dissertation in my own childhood to just, you know, find out what songs were playing on the radio when I was doing this. But I also was going back and digging up old friends. And I thought I remembered a lot about this stuff. And I did remember a lot about this stuff, but there was one blind spot. There was one thing I hadn't really allowed myself to acknowledge, which was my own utter cowardice. I mean, the degree to which I bailed out on other kids who were in threatening situations and saved my own skin, and the degree to which I kind of cringed and keened on the ground, just begging not to be hurt. And I had a couple of friends lead me very patiently and gently to the memory of how I would fall down before I was even hit, and that's an image that is kind of pathetic but also funny. And I gave it to Arthur Lom. He's kind of the guy who figures out that strategy.
So I take it you weren't a real physical kid. You were probably reading.
No, well, I was raised as a Quaker, so I wasn't allowed to hit anyone.
Great.
This was basic principle. I was a pacifist. I was meant to be solving these problems with, nonviolent resistance, and I guess that's what that consisted of.
Did that seem unfair to you, that you were supposed to have been nonviolent, you were from this nonviolent background, but on the other hand, in a neighborhood where power and dignity and self-respect were probably measured by your ability to physically stand up for yourself?
Well, there was such a variety. I hope the book shows the kind of enormous palette of approaches that kids in this neighborhood took. And I really have gathered so many into these characters, these small number of rather isolated characters. I've gathered the testimony and the memory and the impression of lots and lots of different responses and strategies. I mean, Arthur, the kid who starts as the cringer and the one who pretends to have asthma in order not to get hit, ends up as this ultimate assimilator, a kid who passes as though he's black himself. He's kind of an early version of, you know, the Beastie Boys archetype. And the strategies and the responses change day to day. It's why it was always so difficult to talk about, because it was a kind of transitive experience. Problems were being worked out in this arena, in a way, and no strategy could ever be stable. So falling down, cringing, that was one moment in my experience. But talking your way out of things, or making friends with people, or turning situations on their ear, I tried to get all of the possible responses into the book, not just the most humiliating ones.
My guest is Jonathan Lethem. His new novel is called The Fortress of Solitude. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jonathan Lethem. His new novel is called The Fortress of Solitude. For the main character growing up in this novel, everything seems to have some kind of like racial subtext, and certainly the music does. And there's a great paragraph I want you to read about a record that kind of strikes terror into the heart of your main character,
right,
Dylan. Should we say what the record is before you read it, or...
Well, it sort of emerges, so either way.
No, let's let it emerge.
Okay. It was entirely possible that one song could destroy your life. Yes, musical doom could fall on a lone human form and crush it like a bug. The song, that song, was sent from somewhere else to find you, to pick the scab of your whole existence. The song was your personal crappy fate, manifest as a throb of pop floating out of radios everywhere. At the very least, the song was the soundtrack to your destruction, the theme. Your days reduced to a montage cut to its cowbell beat, inexorable doubled bass line and raunch vocal, a sort of chanted sneer surrounded by groans of pleasure. The stutter and blurt of what, a tuba? French horn? Rhythm guitar and trumpet pitched to mockery. The singer might as well have held a gun to your head. How could it have been allowed to happen? How could it have been allowed on the radio? That song ought to be illegal. It wasn't racist. You'll never sort that one out. Don't even start. So much as anti-you. Yes, they were dancing and singing and moving to the groovin', and just when it hit me, somebody turned around and shouted. Every time your sneakers met the street, the end of that summer, somebody was hurling it at your head, that song. Forget what happens when you start haunting the green-tiled halls of Intermediate School 293. September 7th, 1976, the week Dylan Ebdus began seventh grade in the main building on Court Street in Butler, Wild Cherry's Play That Funky Music was the top song on the rhythm and blues charts. 14 days later, it topped Billboard's pop charts. Your Misery's Anthem, number one song in the nation. Sing it through gritted teeth. White boy. Lay down the boogie and play that funky music till you die.
And for anyone who doesn't know the record, it's, you know, it's Play That Funky Music, White Boy.
Well, I later found out my copy editor discovered that White Boy isn't in the title. it stops at Play That Funky Music. So,
but it's in the song.
It's in the song.
So now later on, your character becomes a music critic. And it's
right.
It's only later on in life that he realizes that the band that did Play That Funky Music, White Boy, was actually a white band.
Those are white guys who inflicted that on him, yeah.
So what's the difference to him, whether it's a black group or a white group? How does the meaning change in his mind?
Well, Dylan, this character, he reads race and culture and music so intensely to try to discover what's wrong with the way he feels about himself. And he's tormented by these ironies, these kinds of double reverses. You know, I come from a family of right-thinking leftists, and yet I'm constantly accused of racism just for being beaten up in school. He's tormented by the ironies of his own freedom to escape the situation by hanging out with other white kids and leaving the neighborhood, including his dear black friends, behind. And he's completely tormented by the musical ironies, that the things he loves the most, the things that seem to tell him how he feels about himself, don't match his apparent, cultural portfolio. And then, of course, the fact that this song that he kind of adores and loathes for pinning him to his place in time and culture, for being he's like the white boy in the crosshairs of this song. The fact that it was a bunch of spaced out Midwestern, a bar band basically that created this black sounding hit, it drives him out, absolutely crazy. These guys know nothing of black experience as far as he can tell.
Did this record mean anything to you when you were growing up?
Well, sure. I mean, it was sort of the bane of my existence, but it's kind of irresistible. You could only laugh at yourself for having it trapped in your head because it was being sort of turned against you. But it was the thing that exposed you. It made you naked that this song was on the radio at this time in your life, and that the phrase white boy, which was already beginning to dog your steps, was suddenly okay. It was in the cultural vocabulary. It was the number one song on the radio.
Jonathan Lethem is the author of the new novel, The Fortress of Solitude. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader. Available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback novel I Don't Know How She Does It by Allison Pearson. From Warner Home Video, featuring the films of James Cagney, Humphrey Bogart, and Errol Flynn in the new Warner Legends collection on DVD. And by Dutton Books, publisher of La Faire, a comedy of manners and culture clash by Diane Johnson, author of Le Divorce. An excerpt is available at authordianejohnson.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actress Maggie Gyllenhaal. She starred in the film Secretary and acted with her brother Jake Gyllenhaal in Donnie Darko. She's one of the stars in John Sayles' new film Casa de los Babies. And we continue our conversation with novelist Jonathan Lethem.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jonathan Lethem. His novel Motherless Brooklyn won a National Book Critics Circle Award. His new novel, The Fortress of Solitude, is based on his own experiences growing up in Brooklyn, where he was one of the few white people in his school. The novel follows the characters and the neighborhood from the 70s through the 90s, through the eras of hip-hop, crack, and gentrification. You know, as you've pointed out, the people in your life kind of related to their world through culture, whether it was, you know, graffiti or music or you know, a painting. And your father is a painter. Dylan's father in the novel is a painter as well. But the father in the novel is also, instead of painting on canvases, he's doing this experimental painting on film, so his images can have motion. And the father takes the son to a talk by Stan Brakhage, the famous experimental filmmaker. And Brakhage is saying things like, "I would rather see my work as an attempt to clear aesthetic areas, to free film from previous arts and ideologies, perhaps to leave it clear to be of use to men and women of various kinds, which might help evolve human sensibility." I'm wondering if your father had that kind of more abstracted, intellectualized approach to art and what that meant to you, if you, you know, because Dylan in the novel is kind of fascinated by this, and he's hanging on every word, but it doesn't understand a word of it.
Yeah. Actually, my father's own painting is much more messy and engaged than anything I've given to this father character in the book. Abraham's film is a kind of super purified and he's a very hermetic artist. And his practice is very isolated and monk-like. It's actually, in some ways, Abraham's a confession of my own work as a writer. That painted film and this incremental progress day by day is really a description of a writer working on a long novel. It's a self-portrait. My father's painting was, and his life as an artist, was much more ground level. He was really engaged with the neighborhood and his work is very colorful and full of content and full of politics, and his studio was always full of live models, many of them just people from the neighborhood, and he was very engaged. So Abraham's hermetic style is a kind of an exaggeration of, you know, the response to living in a confusing place that I flirted with, which was to just pretend you didn't know anything about it.
Right. In writing about race in your new novel, were you afraid at any point that you would be misunderstood? Because it's such a loaded subject, and people are always reading between the lines to see what is your motivation? What are you really saying? So were you afraid that you'd be misunderstood and that
of
you
course.
Might come off as sounding racist, in spite of the fact that that's certainly not your intention?
Well, of course. And I mean, I had to embrace that fear. You know, I wasn't trying to write a very short, simple book that could be purified of ambivalence or confusion. There's a lot of stuff in it that probably kind of is racist in its way, back and forth. You know, there are characters who are racist, and it's an embrace of my own experience, and I wanted to keep it kind of scrupulously intimate, and as I said at the start, make it like a testimony of one person, one body in time, not preach or pontificate or pretend to have figured things out that our culture hasn't figured out. But the fear was with me all the way through, of course.
When you were growing up, you know, your mother was a social activist, your father a painter. You've also described your mother as a hippie. And, you know, people who are in the arts or people who were hippies, bohemians, often see themselves as being like outside of class. It's like the bohemian class is sometimes outside of, you know, working class, middle class, upper class. At least that's how it's sometimes perceived by the larger culture, and that's how they sometimes perceive themselves. As a child of that type of family, did you feel outside of social class, or did you feel a part of it, and where did you think you fit?
Well, I had a kind of beautiful, a blissful confusion about class that came from the vitality of my parents' bohemian milieu. Their world was so full of life and art and energy that I never thought to wonder whether we were deprived of something. It didn't make any sense to think of myself as being from a poor family, despite, you know, what in retrospect might have been kind of whopping clues, like the fact that I did go to public school instead of private school. And it was more possible to sustain that blissful confusion that surrounded my family. I didn't understand that there was real privilege. I did understand that the kids living in the projects down the street, you know, had less than we did. So if anything, I thought we were probably rich. But I didn't think about it very coherently.
Now, you went to public school, and your parents are very proud of that fact, that you were in public school. What kind of education do you think you got in the public school in your neighborhood?
Well, you know, the experience changed again and again. I was pulled out of my grade school, my local grade school, the one that I leave Dylan in, I actually left behind, to go to kind of cross neighborhoods into a Carroll Gardens, which was a mostly Italian neighborhood. So suddenly I was among a lot of other white kids who nonetheless saw me as another kind of outsider or freak. But strictly speaking, the education there was magnificent. I had the best teacher of my life in fourth grade, a woman named Carmen Farina, who I dedicated my first novel to. And she was as in love with books and talking and culture and life as my parents were. And so suddenly school was very, very alive for me. And that happened again when I got to high school. I went to Music and Art, which is this great public school. And, you know, it's a kind of legendary public school in New York with a legacy of, you know, all sorts of funny, famous people who went there. And I was part of this great tradition there. Again, one that was sort of classless and very utopian. So I was lucky. And New York City has vestiges of, you know, the greatest public education system ever constructed, I suspect. And I was in and out of really exciting schools, actually.
Jonathan Leatham, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Leatham's new novel is called The Fortress of Solitude. Coming up, actress Maggie Gyllenhaal. This is Fresh Air. My guest Maggie Gyllenhaal starred in the popular independent film Secretary. She played a withdrawn young woman who was awakened by a sadomasochistic relationship with her boss. In the movie Donnie Darko, she played the sister of a troubled young man who was portrayed by Gyllenhaal's real brother, Jake Gyllenhaal. Now she's one of the stars of the new John Sayles film Casa de los Babies. She plays the youngest of a group of women who have gone to an unnamed Latin American country to adopt babies, and they're growing impatient of waiting. The ensemble cast includes Marcia Gay Harden, Mary Steenburgen, Lily Taylor, and Daryl Hannah. The actresses stayed at a hotel during the early phase of the film, but then they moved into a house together for the duration. Gyllenhaal told me that she thinks she and the other actresses were unconsciously behaving a bit like their characters.
You know, the person I play in the movie I think, is not comfortable in her brain, which is not to say that she's not smart. I mean, I think she's as smart as I am, because otherwise, I mean, I just don't think you can play someone who's not as smart as you are. I don't think that's a possibility. But she doesn't feel confident and comfortable in her brain. And it was really hard to be down there that way with all of these actresses who I really respected, who I think, you know, all of them are really interesting. And I was unusually quiet and unusually unprotected, I think. And I think that each actress had an experience like that in their own way.
Well, you made this John Sayles movie right before you made Secretary, so even though the movie's coming out after Secretary, it was filmed the other way around.
It wasn't, actually. I made Secretary, and it came out about a month after I finished filming the John Sayles movie.
Well, you must have felt like all these actresses didn't know what you had really what you had really just done.
Yeah, I did. I did, kind of. But Mary Steenburgen, actually, I knew a little bit, and she'd seen me do some theater, and she was really supportive of it and great. But, yeah, but I did. I kind of felt like, I'm an actress, too. You know, I mean, yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Secretary. And, you know, in this movie, for our listeners who haven't seen it, your character is a young woman who's just come out of a psychiatric hospital. She's a cutter. She cuts herself. And she obviously has no confidence in herself. She's miserable at home. She takes a secretarial job with this really strange lawyer, played by James Spader. And after a while, when he criticizes her typing, in addition to the verbal criticism, he spanks her. And she actually likes it. And they develop this sadomasochistic relationship that is very fulfilling for each of them. And they even get married at the end, and it ends up being quite romantic. What was your interpretation of this character?
My interpretation has shifted a lot, actually. I mean, at the moment, I think it's a really political movie. John Sayles' movie also is very political, you know, Casa de los Babies. And Secretary, I think, seems like it's more of a, you know, really, really dark romantic comedy. And it is. But the more I think about it, I think it's the most radical movie that I've made, or really the most radical thing I've done in my life so far.
So what's your political interpretation of your character?
Well, I think it's a complicated thing to make a movie about somebody who is opened up and moved and, I think, woken up by playing the submissive in an S&M relationship. Because I think it makes you question what is okay politically. Is it okay that this woman is opened up and moved by this? Well, if she is, then it has to be okay on some level. And, you know, I think it's also in a lot of ways about moving through a kind of old school feminism, I guess, is what I've been calling it lately, which I think is something that I'm resting everything I have on. You know, I mean, my grandmother on my mother's side was a doctor, and my mother's a screenwriter, and I feel like I'm coming from a really privileged place to be able to question some of this old school feminism, you know, where I think there were rules set up to protect women against all sorts of inequality. You know, you can't act this way, you can't say this, you have to pay a woman this.
And a certain kind of sexuality is demeaning.
Yeah. And a certain kind of behavior in the workplace is demeaning. And, you know, just don't cross these lines, because if you cross them, we'll fall off this very tenuous line we're walking. I guess I feel like those rules, which have been really helpful, I mean, unbelievably helpful, and I don't at all take for granted, if they're not questioned, can start to feel just as oppressive as what they were trying to protect us from.
In preparation for the role, did you read any of the, you know, like bad girl feminist literature? Because there's a whole like library of feminist literature about the pleasures of dark sexual relationships, like S&M relationships. I mean, there's a whole kind of body of like theoretical works about
yeah,
that.
Yeah. You know, I think Mary Gateskill, who
she'd kind of be part of that, right?
She would totally be part of that. Secretary is actually the mildest, I think, of her bad girl literature. You know, I mean, in the book, the story, Secretary, it's about a girl who, I mean, it's very short. It's like 5 pages long. It's about a girl who gets a job in a lawyer's office. He ultimately spanks her. And she feels degraded and strange and somewhat turned on by feeling degraded and strange and doesn't know how to order it, I think is really more what the story says. And the movie says, I don't think I feel degraded and strange. I know I didn't feel degraded and strange. You know, I felt complicated things. And I think that's what's interesting about it, is that there are dark things as well as light things in the sex and the love that they have in that movie. But I think it's mostly opening and moving.
Obviously, you have this this kind of interesting and complicated analysis that takes into account feminism. You know, an analysis of the film and of your character. Some of the people who see the movie probably just see it as, hey, it's a cool movie about sadomasochistic sex, you know?
Yeah.
And aren't kind of operating on that level. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you've gotten feedback from any of them and whether that more, like, superficial and in some instances maybe even crass interpretation, how that affects you personally. Because it's not only, like, your acting that's on the line here, it's your body, because there's, you mm-hmm. know, there's a nude scene and so on. So, you know, what's it like to not be interpreted on the level that you are operating on?
I think it is scary to me in some ways. I think it's so scary to me how the movie could be interpreted, how my body could be interpreted, that I have put up a really strong defense against feeling that fear, to be honest. You know, I did an interview a while ago, and this guy who was interviewing me said, yeah, you know, I watched Secretary in the movie theater, and then I came home, and a friend of mine said, oh, here, I've got a tape of it. Let's just fast forward to the sexy parts. And I didn't feel anything when he said it. I mean, I didn't, like, you know, giggle and say, that's fine or something. I just sort of shut it out completely and went on with the 10-minute interview I had to do with him. And afterwards, I just took a breath and felt that. And I think that that's such a sort of strange, awful thing for him to have said to me. I almost couldn't take it in at the moment that he said it. And when I did take it in, I mean, it's a level of having my body and my mind be out of my control that it's hard to fathom.
Right.
At the same time, though, you know, I feel like it's kind of worth it. And I thought about it. I thought, you know, yeah, I've had some weird responses to having been naked in Secretary. I think that I really clearly chose to be naked to say something that I think was important and worth saying. I don't know if I'll continue to feel that way as I get older and continue to do this.
Well, just like another thing about Secretary, in preparation for the role, in addition to, you know, like reading what you read, did you also like read just like straight out S&M pornography or Rent, straight out S&M videos? To get a sense of like that world, that culture.
Well, I started out reading some S&M pornography and also some S&M, like, theory stuff. You know who I really liked from that is Robert Coover, who wrote this book, Spanking the Maid. Was really interesting. He's a novelist.
Yeah, he's a real, like, literary guy.
He's a real literary guy. Yeah. But I did. I started out reading that stuff, and I was totally unmoved by it. I mean, I just wasn't moved by it. And actually, the stuff that I was reading, and maybe it wasn't the best stuff, and I probably could have done better research and found better stuff, was, you know, stuff like, this unnamed person likes to do this sexy, kinky thing. And, you know, it all felt really other and exotic and, you know, different from me somehow, very separate from me. And it wasn't helping me. And then I got this porno, which was, at first I felt the same way about. I felt like, you know, it's these two women, and was really intense S&M stuff. This girl was really being sort of beaten up by this other woman. And at first I felt like, this is not helping me. This is making me feel like this is so far from my sense of sexuality and my sense of love. At first I thought that. And then this porno, and I've never seen a porno where they've done this before. They zoomed in on the woman who was being hurt. They zoomed in on her face, and I was just looking at her face, and it was undeniable that she was overwhelmed with feeling. And I think that, I mean, I've never seen a porno where I felt like anyone was feeling anything really real.
Was the real feeling pain?
Well, you know, it's hard to distinguish. It was an overwhelming feeling of something. And, you know, if you know, in the movie, in Secretary Lee, the character I play, is so dead in the beginning of the movie, I think she's sleepwalking. And she's kind of okay to do that because she's seen no other option. I think it takes something undeniable, like physical pain, to wake her up.
Well, she's been inflicting it on herself. She's been a cutter up until the point where she gets involved in the relationship, yeah.
I think it's sort of different. I think the cutting stuff is, you know, there's a lot of pain in her life, which I think, you know, it's her, there's this stuff about her parents fighting and her dad's a drunk and, you know, beating her mom up and stuff like that. And I think that's what causes, you know, in the movie anyway, a lot of the cutting stuff. But I think, you know, her family is just uninterested in dealing with it. Her mother's like, happy, great. You know, in the script, her mother used to offer her candy anytime anything would go wrong. So I think, you know, she has no way of ordering this really complicated, real human emotional pain that she's dealing with. So she puts it into a little cut and you know, gets to sort of keep it all in one physical place and watch it heal. Whereas I think the S&M stuff in the movie is more about exploding feeling into her body and then I think ultimately her mind and her heart. And I can't tell you why those two different kinds of pain work in such different ways, but they do.
My guest is Maggie Gyllenhaal. She played the title role in the film Secretary. Now she's one of the stars of John Sayles' new film Casa de los Babies. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Maggie Gyllenhaal is my guest, and she starred in the film Secretary. She's now co-starring in the John Sayles film Casa de los Babies. I'd like to talk a little bit about your family. Your mother, Naomi Foner, is a screenwriter. Your father, Stephen Gyllenhaal, is a director. Your brother, Jake Gyllenhaal, is like you, a new star. So when you were growing up, did you have, like, overhearing your parents' conversations and then hearing what they told you about movies. Mm-hmm. Did this sound like the kind of thing you wanted to do when you grew up? Did it sound like a good deal? Did it sound like interesting work? Or did it sound like a lot of, like, headaches?
I remember Deborah Winger. This was when I was a little older. I was probably, like, 14. But they made A Dangerous Woman with her. And I remember her coming over for lunch. And my dad or my mom, I can't remember, one of them saying, look, she's dressing like the person that she's playing. And I thought that was really fascinating. And I've thought about that a lot since then. You know, just, I mean, what an interesting thing. And especially if it's unconscious, you know, then how interesting. Because that happens to me. I think I'm realizing more and more, you know, I won't realize while it's happening, but, you know, I made a movie in the last winter where I was playing someone really glamorous and interested in herself as a sexy, well-dressed woman. And I found the way I wanted, what I wanted to adorn myself with shifted. Or when I made Casa de los Babies, I mean, really shifted, you know, the way I, what I felt was beautiful, what I felt was not beautiful, how I felt about myself as a person, as a, you know.
Is this a transitional period for you where people in the movie industry are figuring out that you're I guess they figured this out already, that you're not just you know, Naomi Foner and Stephen Gyllenhaal's kid, that you're an adult, you're your own person now. Because when people know you as the son or daughter of somebody, it's sometimes hard to have them see you as who you really are beyond that.
Mm-hmm. The person in my family that it's gotten the most complicated with is my mother. You know, there was a point last year when I was going, it was during all this award stuff, and I was, you know, it was the first time I've ever had, you know, gone to any of this, you know, this party and this thing and that thing, and it was both exhausting and thrilling to me, all of it. But some of these places where I was invited to go or interested in going, like, you know, there's a film company called Killer Films, and some of my good friends work there. And my mother is working with one of my good friends on developing a movie. And so I was, invited to this party. It was a party of people who I felt were my contemporaries. My mother was also invited to this party. She felt it was a party of people who were her contemporaries, you know, because there were all sorts of different ages of people at this party. And I felt really conflicted, you know. I'm going to go to this party and my mom's going to be there, you know.
Right.
And I thought it was really great that my mother said, I want to do everything I can to respect you. I mean, this is finally what she said. It was harder at first, but finally she said, I want to respect you. I also need you to respect me, which is a much more kind of give and take adult kind of conversation than you know, any kind of conversations we had ever had before. You know, with my brother, it's easier. I mean, he's my brother. It's fine. He goes to a party with me. It's great. He's my friend, you know, or
right,
he...
Right.
And he and I have had to deal more with being competitive and getting jealous. I mean, there have been times when, you know, it seems like we wouldn't be up for the same things, but we're both interested in, you know, the one good movie that's being made in, you know, a couple of months' time, and the two characters that we could play are lovers.
Can't do that.
No.
Can't go there.
So only one of us can do it. And, you know, but I think we've actually been doing pretty well. I mean, I think all of this stuff... we've been, and this is in retrospect, but, you know, we've been using as a way of communicating about more complicated things.
Well, I hate to end it here, but we're out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure.
Maggie Gyllenhaal is one of the stars of John Sayles' new film, Casa de los Babies. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Warner Home Video, featuring Yankee Doodle Dandy, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, and The Adventures of Robin Hood as part of the Warner Legends Collection on DVD. From Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Mission Flats, a novel of suspense set in Boston by William Landay, and by Nonesuch Records, now featuring the Randy Newman Songbook, Volume 1. The first ever solo studio album by Randy Newman, with all new recordings available at all Barnes & Noble music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Marianne Pearl talks about the death of her husband, Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter who was kidnapped and murdered in Pakistan by Islamic extremists in 2002. She's written a new memoir. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.